So the topic continues to be the 13th step of the mindfulness of breathing, observing one trains oneself, observing in constancy, I will breathe in. Observing in constancy, I will breathe out, is how the instructions are. And this observing of inconstancy, usually translated as impermanence, is really, as I said yesterday, is the core insight of insight meditation, the core insight of the Buddha's teachings in the ancient texts. And the definition of that the Buddha gave repeatedly for wisdom is the perception of arising and passing, the insight into the arising and disappearing of phenomena that is noble and penetrating and leads to the ending of suffering. So it's the experience, the perception of seeing things arise and pass that leads to liberation, to awakening. And so this inconstancy, the way that inconstancy is understood here is it is the it's defined as over in many different words in the ancient language that are equivalent to the English arising and passing, appearing and disappearing, things like that. And it's hard to understand, to appreciate how valuable this is to have this experience until one experiences in a very deep, subtle, quiet place in meditation. That's really where this deep insight is really, it's really insight that works and it's very penetrating and noble awakening when the mind is really ready for seeing that. If in ordinary consciousness, walking around the street, someone tells you just to notice the arising and passing of phenomena, it probably won't stick. It probably won't be any sense of continuity with that, resting in it, just being open to it, because you have to take care of too many details walking on the street and figuring out what's going on. But in deep meditation, to be really at rest and really able to be centered in a receptive, open, observing way of the flow of experience in awareness, that's possible because we're not overlaying concepts and ideas on top of things. We're just there in the direct experience of phenomena, of perception and sensations and the beginning of thoughts, and even with emotions that might feel in ordinary street consciousness as being continuous, when your mind is very quiet and still, we're beginning to feel and sense the how they actually kind of momentarily, fleetingly coming into existence and out of existence. There's a coming into awareness and out of awareness. The mind picks it up and doesn't pick it up. And generally what happens is we sew all these different moments of arising and passing together into a feeling of constancy, into idea that it's continuous. But when we don't have ideas anymore, just in the experience, this arising and passing occurs. And this is meant to be, this is supposed to be liberating, to do this. And partly it's because when we see that things are constantly in flux, that it's hard to, it doesn't make sense to cling to them, to grasp onto them. It's like you're seeing the river flow by and it's clearly moving and in flux. And then you put your hand in there to grab the river and hold it, and you grab a handful of the river and you pull it up. And by the time you open your hand to hold the river, all the water has kind of squeezed out of your fingers and run off. And you might have a little bit of drops left on your hand, but you don't go with those drops of water in your hand and go up to your friends on the shore and say, "Hey, look, I have the river in my hand." If you think you're holding the river because you have those few little drops, you know that's no longer the river. The river is partly defined by water that's flowing, and those drops are no longer in that flow. And so the idea of picking something out of the flow of experience and holding on to it, if we're in the flow, really centered in it, then we see, we've actually left the flow. We've actually now kind of holding something, an idea of something that's just a little drop, just a little, maybe even, I don't know what. And so it turns out that so much of what we get attached to, cling to, resist, is not actually reality, but the idea, interpretation, the concept we have of reality. And so it's hard to explain that to people in ordinary consciousness, but to really be centered and quiet and see the flow of the vibratory flow of the sparkling flow, the raindrop being on the lake appearing and disappearing a phenomena, it becomes glaringly obvious that it doesn't make sense to cling to it. It doesn't make sense to resist to it, but rather is to open to it and just allow it to move through and just allow it to flow and move in there. And generally when that happens, our relationship to that experience changes dramatically. So even if it's been we have physical pain, which is very hard to be with, I know, but when we really, the ability of being concentrated and still and feel it all as flowing sensation, the pain gets transformed into something else that doesn't really feel painful anymore. It's a flow of this arising and passing of sensations that becomes a whole different way of experiencing it. But it requires the mind being very still and focused and present and quiet to do that. So this is the core insight, to see the appearing and disappearing of phenomena. In the guided meditation, I was focusing mostly on the arising, and at some point we'll do a meditation just focusing on the passing away of phenomena, and then the arising and passing of phenomena that occur together. But so our relationship to things begins to shift. And there's a wonderful verse, the Dhammapada, where it starts with a kind of a quote that all things are inconstant. So everything is arising and passing. So even things that are continuous and from ordinary consciousness seem like they're just unchanging. In some way or other, in the mind's way of experiencing it, it's the experience that's arising and passing. So we want to be a little bit careful we're not getting too wrapped up in the thing that we're perceiving is inconstant. It's the way, it's the nature of how experience happens that's inconstant. There's a momentary, kind of like pixelated nature of reality, or this flow of experience that comes and goes, that is built into the very nature of how we are aware, how we experience things. So, so here the Buddha says, all created things are inconstant, and the word is sankhara, I'd like to suggest that what we're talking about is all created experiences, all ways in which the mind perceives and takes in and constructs our reality. Everything like that is just is inconstant. It's in flux and in moving. And seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. One becomes disenchanted with suffering. So whoever believes that they're enchanted with suffering? Enchanted means, maybe it kind of means enamored, it means kind of caught in the spell of it. Somehow, if we hate our suffering, we're caught in its spell. We're enchanted by it in a certain way. I guess if that means in English to be under its spell. If we hate something, we're under its spell, we're caught, we're entangled. And there's something about seeing the inconstancy of experience that helps us to disentangle ourselves, to break that spell, to not be so caught in it. And so all things are inconstant. All created things are inconstant, all sankharas. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering, This is the path of purity. This is the path of purity. So it's a little bit problematic, this idea of purity, but just a few verses before, they talk about purity this way. This is the path for purifying one's vision, purifying our awareness, our vision, how we see things. So it's not necessarily becoming a completely, you know, a saint inside, that kind of purity, but rather it's coming to a place where our capacity to be aware is purified of all the filters of thoughts, ideas, reactions, emotions that prevent us from seeing clearly. But to really see clearly, see things as they are, we want to see the inconstancy of phenomena. Then the verse goes on. All created things are suffering. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. And here we have the second of the three characteristics. The three are inconstancy, suffering, and the third is not self. And these three characteristics are the core insights of insight meditation. It starts with arising and passing. In seeing the arising and passing, there's something about seeing that level of our experience, that layer of our experience, that gives birth to a clear insight into, and here the translator, which is me, translates as suffering. The word is dukkha, and for now it could be more usefully translated in this context as stressful, but we'll talk more about that on Monday. And then it goes on to say, all things are not self. Seeing this with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. So we'll continue this idea of the three characteristics, which are so phenomenally important for insight meditation that it's worth spending some time with it. And this movement of seeing inconstancy, observing inconstancy, has an impact on the meditator. And the impact is a process of disenchantment, of breaking the spell of how we're caught or entangled or clinging or attached to things. And where the allure, the promise of attachment, the promise that grasping will somehow save us or do something for us, begins to be broken. So you might want to today, during this weekend, look a little bit at this idea of inconstancy and arising and passing of phenomena, and see if somehow that casts any perspective on how you might be enchanted with suffering or caught in its spell. So, I have a little bit of time today, so we can stop formally here, but if some of you would like to stay a little bit longer and put some questions in the chat, I'm happy to try to answer. And I might not be able to answer them in order, but if you would like to try, I'm happy to stay and for a little while. Inconstancy is not bad news. Aha, nice. So, are the transcripts of your talks? Yes, but I don't think they're not necessarily coming right away. But there's a wonderful team of people who are transcribing these talks in the morning, and I think some of the earlier ones are available now from earlier in the year or before. So, if you go on Audio Dharma, where the audio recording of them appear, it'll say if there's a transcription available, and they're lightly edited, luckily. So, and the person leading up that wonderful project of transcribing is Meg Galler, who often says hello here in the morning. So, thank you so much, Meg, and your team for this great work you're doing. Where does awareness go when we are caught in thinking? A lovely question. Where does it go? Where does it go? Well, it depends what we mean by awareness. If awareness is not the same as consciousness, but awareness is conscious awareness, if there's knowing awareness, we know what we're aware of, we know what's coming into consciousness. There's a lot of things we know that are come into awareness that we don't really, clearly, fully, I know that. For example, just saying all this, I was aware that I have these lights on here, and the kind of studio lights, just that I was aware of this light, that, and then I knew, the light is on. But it wasn't the second kind of the knowing of it is different than just kind of I go about and not paying attention. I don't think about it. I don't have any act of formal recognition. With thinking, our consciousness, our awareness, I like to think of it as it gets hijacked and held hostage by our thinking. We get so glued to our thinking that kind of self-reflective awareness that we know what's happening and what we're doing, we know that we're thinking, gets lost because it's so preoccupied, so glued to it. So that's probably an inadequate answer, but then we'll have to leave it at that. Can you say more about dealing with pain, especially for those with chronic illness? Yeah, that's a huge topic it's a very, very important one. There's a lot of people who have pain and are managing their life with pain and chronic illness. And I think one of the great benefits of mindfulness meditation in circumstances like that is to help us not add second arrows to it. When we already have tremendous difficulty in trying to figure out and working our life with this difficulty, to not add shame or self-incrimination or resentment or anger, or to not get attached to it. Should have been different. Why isn't it different? I should have, whatever it might be. The second arrows, but to learn how to be simpler and simpler, and to allow ourselves to be ill and painful in the simplest possible way, maybe even an ordinary way, as if, oh yes, I'm sick, that's what's happening. And then absolutely take care of ourselves, try to be well, and try to do what we can to heal the pain or overcome the illness. And this is not a passivity that we want to have about it. But we do what we can, and sometimes we can't do much. And the practice can help us then become very simple with it and breathe with it and not add extra tension and stress to the already stressful situation. And then as the mindfulness gets stronger and more concentrated, then it's possible to bring a careful, loving, compassionate attention deeply into the pain and the illness, to really feel the direct experience of it. And that sometimes allows there to be different kinds of shifts and beneficial shifts. And I don't want to say exactly how those beneficial shifts will look like, different for different people. And I don't want to set up the expectation that mindfulness can help make the pain go completely away or the illness go away, and that it's healing that way. But it can be healing for the heart, the mindfulness practice. So the illness and the pain might not go away, but the heart is healed. And that's the movement of liberation. And then we become whole in a certain way. Is closed captioning available for these talks? I believe they are through YouTube, but haven't tracked all this so well. I'll try to find out, but I believe there's a way, maybe down in the settings and on YouTube, you can, they're that way. It kind of goes by quickly, so I can't do them in order, I apologize. Are thoughts the central mechanism as to how we cling to these constant phenomena? I don't know if thoughts are the mechanism for clinging, but at least in my experience, that mostly what we cling to is our thoughts, is our ideas. And it's not so obvious until you really see how this works in a deep, quiet way. So we don't really cling to physical pleasure, but it's more like we're clinging to what the pleasures, what the thoughts, the ideas, the that we have about what these the pleasure is doing for us. Oh, to get to the deepest levels of insight, it seems we have to let go of every to-do list in our life. How can we function in the world if we want to go to the deepest levels of insight? Great question. Yes, to get to the deepest level of freedom, you have to put aside or let go of any clinging, all clinging. And but we can still hold things without clinging. So, you know, I can be attached to the striker, and I can feel I'm attached to it. I'm so, you know, I should therefore let go of it, and I can just drop it. But another way of letting, it's not the thing that we necessarily have to let go of. When we get let go of attachment, it's not the thing, unless it's, you know, harmful. And the striker is not harmful in itself. It's the clinging we let go of. So then we can go like this. And we can still hold it without any grasping. So in deep meditation, we want to put everything aside. And so with a to-do list, you would maybe put it on a to-do list on a piece of paper and put it up on a shelf, leave it on your table, and just put it aside. And then later you come back to it and then look at it and hold all the things on the to-do list with this open hand, an open mind, and then go through them and have the pleasure of checking them off. But don't get attached to any of it or clinging to any of it. So you're welcome to keep your to-do list. And hopefully the deep letting go and the deep wisdom of meditation helps you to look at that list and prioritize in a good way. And maybe few of the things on the list are not necessary. A few of the things maybe represent something you're attached to. Maybe. Attached to unnecessarily. There seems to be two kinds of inconstancy. How our awareness flickers and then perhaps wraps things up in a constant narrative, the flickering inconsistency of phenomena itself. Is that correct? Yeah, that sounds nice. But things are not random. The inconsistency of what appears and disappears is not completely random, but it arises because of preceding conditions. So nothing arises out of nothing, but the conditions come together and then things arise. And so in Dharma practice, we're actually putting in place the conditions so that we have more consistency, so that we have more likely that we move in a certain direction, we grow in a certain direction, certain kinds of arising tends to arise more often. So for example, if you practice a lot of loving kindness, then that sets the conditions that when you sit and we feel pain, we're ready to feel a compassion, maybe, and love for ourselves and care for ourselves than we are to be angry with ourselves or angry with other people because of what's happening to us. And so there's inconsistency, but we begin to shape that inconsistency so it tends in one direction, in a beneficial direction. So would you please say more about the Buddha never said no self? Or he had a sense of self. Yeah, so we'll talk about that next week when we get to not self in this exploration of inconstancy. Tetanus, I think it's tinnitus. Tinnitus. There we go. Oh, tonight, yeah, so where is it? I guess I missed the question, but tinnitus, I have tinnitus, so one of the best things for me is if no one brings up the word, because then if I'm reminded, then I start hearing the ringing in my ears. So, there are times where I've been really troubled by this, really drove me kind of batty. The ringing in my ears, But now I'm not troubled by it anymore, and it kind of recedes. Some people find it useful to make it the object of meditation, and it has a kind of constancy that is grounding for some people. I found it. I've never found it particularly useful to pay attention to it. And in fact, some teachers actually say this is one of the things in your mindfulness practice you shouldn't pay attention to. The idea is to pay attention to everything in mindfulness, but not to pay attention to that. So that all depends on the person and what's useful and not useful. But I mostly these days don't give it much attention and don't. I've learned not to react to it, not to be for or against it, okay, there it is, and then I'll continue with my breathing and sit there and practice and go on with other things. And I know for some people it's really bad, they just have some kind of ambient sound around, and that sometimes, masks it, hides it. It's a challenge to hold one's tongue and only observe. Yes, this is advanced graduate school mindfulness, to be mindful of speaking. And there's so much attachment, so much force and power and desires that come into play in speaking. But it's so beneficial to bring mindfulness to thinking. It's a window into, to say it in non-Buddhist dramatic terms, to really be mindful of our talking and what drives our talking and why we're going to say what we're going to do, and what is the emotional motivation for our talking. It's kind of like a dramatic window into our soul, into our depth of who we actually are. So it's certainly worthwhile to learn to do that. So Meg writes, closed captioning equals the oral notes on Audio Dharma. Oh, someone says, yeah, closed captioning on YouTube is not available live, but seems to show up later on. If things are inconstant and clinging to them causes us to suffer, what does that mean for choices of the heart like marriage and career? If things are inconstant and clinging to them causes us to suffer, what does it mean for choices of the heart like marriage or a career? Well, ideally, we would choose marriage or a career without any clinging. And in the flow of things are, there's still make choices that the direction we want our lives and the purpose of our lives, the meaning of our lives, and what we want to really put our heart into more than anything else. We don't have to just kind of go randomly along with whatever happens. And it's a beautiful thing for some people to have a career or have a marriage that they want. To devote themselves to and be engaged in. Other people make other choices that are just as good and valuable. Now with something like marriage and maybe with careers as well, if we wait until we have no clinging and no craving, no attachment, the Buddhist idea of attachment, craving, clinging, before we get married, then perhaps most people wouldn't get married. Because in Buddhism it's not a sin or a crime to be attached and to cling. It just means we're going to suffer somewhat because of it. But one way to approach something like marriage and career, any choice we make for our lives, is to fold it into our mindfulness practice, fold it into our careful care and attention and compassion for where is our clinging, where is our attachment. And marriage, it can be a great place to, and family and kids, a great place to discover where we're attached, where our clinging, craving are. That maybe is very deep that we wouldn't see in ourselves unless we were in this kind of intimate, committed relationship. And then to work through it and come to the other side of it. So it can be folded in as a path of the practice, as opposed to we avoid all these things because we're clinging. It's probably best not to choose to go into a marriage because you want to work out your clinging. So hopefully that answers the question well enough. What chapter verse from Dhammapada did you cite? Oh, I think it's the chapter, its verse is like in the 170s. Let me see. It is verse 277, that's what I read. And it's in chapter 20, The Path. Yeah, this is I'm reading from my translation that I did 20 years ago or so. And it's a little bit fascinating and a little bit, I don't know if embarrassing, but a little bit of regret that choices, English choice, my study of the suttas was not what it was now. So I would translate some of this differently now, and also the use of gender pronouns. I try to avoid, in order to become more gender neutral, I did many things I did in a gender neutral way, but sometimes I would, if there was two pairs of verses where in the original it was the masculine pronoun, I would do one with he and the other with she. And at the time I thought that was good, but 20 years later, you know, or 10 years later, I understood that it's, we really want to try to be gender neutral more fully because of how many people don't fit into the binary of he and she. And so I regret that I left it in that. I mean, I didn't know enough back then to make that choice. So, oh, someone asks Meg if need more help with transcription, and someone else as well. Yeah, so she says you can contact IMC volunteer coordinator Hilary Borison. You can, I think if you go on the IMC's website, there's probably a place there for volunteering, and you could just let Hilary know, and she'll be the support at all. Okay, maybe I'll do one more here. Are these deep insights only really possible with lengthy meditation retreats? Have you read the Harper's article about the possible dangers of this? No, it doesn't require deep insights. But for many people in our tradition at least, it's usually in meditation retreats that this really settles in and really kind of becomes digested, or we see it and are impacted in a very good way. These deep insights, and for most people, and but once we have a clear sense of it and a familiarity with it, then they kind of live in a delightful and wonderful way, much more in our daily life as well. And it doesn't require deep meditation anymore to really have it be part of the landscape, these insights, and affect us. And I might have read the Harper's article. I think I'm pretty familiar with the modern a discussion about the dangers of deep insight meditation. So that's, you know, generally people who want to go into the deeper meditation experiences, it's good to work with a teacher, be close connected so you can ask questions of how it's going. Some of it can be a little bit disorienting. But some of the real dangers that happen has a lot to do with the attitude and way in which people practice. And the people who really strive and push and tend to can have real psychological problems because they're overriding, they're not integrated, there's not a relaxation, there's not a nice broad unification, composure, or collectedness that supports. And so this anapanasati practice is really a fantastic practice because it creates a really good foundation for these insights. I think some of the people who have these end up in a little bit of psychological trouble somehow leapfrog over creating the foundation of practice. They're in a hurry. There's a gung-ho. And so they experience this the deep experiences of inconstancy before they really have the psychological support and well-being and stability to make good use of it. And so if they already have a little bit of psychological instability, it can make it more unstable. So this is a known phenomenon that can happen, and so one of the things that one of the reasons why having some connection to a teacher in meditation retreats is where that can happen. We have that connection and support if something like that happens. So thank you all very much, and then for this morning and your questions, I appreciate them, and I'm sorry if I didn't answer all the questions, and I value them all. Thank you.